As I was asked to address it, I'm very glad because, frankly, it doesn't get talked about as much as it needs to in a circle of people that want to know about the things of God, wanting to know a godly way to be able to celebrate and enjoy all that God intended for us sexually, and how he would have us express that in a way that honors him and is a blessing. And now, in my work, I often talk about these things, but I have the advantage of just talking to one or two people at a time. And I have their interaction, and I don't have that same opportunity here. And there's people with all different stories. And I want there to be a sensitivity that what I'm saying that might be helpful to some may not fit with your story. And I want you to be understanding of those that do need to hear this and do need to hear that our God has a way to redeem and to bless. And so it's with that in mind that I titled this sermon, Sexuality, Beauty and the Beast. You see, because God designed our sexuality to be a thing of beauty, but when sex is forced, it is a very ugly beast. It's very possible that what was intended for good can be used for a great deal of destruction. This topic needs our attention, and incidentally, it is a topic that is dealt with throughout the scripture, from very beginning to very end, repeatedly addressing God's gift, but also the abuses and perversions that are so ugly. Our God designed us as sexual beings, male and female. He instructed us from the beginning to find his blessing in a committed life of living love, and we called that marriage, so that the two could become one, and that that could be celebrated and enjoyed in a sexual union. His instructions weren't to prohibit us or to limit us in enjoyment, but quite the opposite, to increase our enjoyment in the security and the strength of knowing that it would last for a lifetime. That was his desire and his intent. By his design, we would come to deeply and intimately know one another. Oh, when I took on this assignment as I was asked, and yes, we are going to be dealing with 2 Samuel and the story of Tamar, but I said, if we're going to talk about sexuality and in its abuse, I need to take some time to set the background as to what was the godly desire of its intent in the first place. So that's what I'm doing now. There's a Hebrew word you've probably heard used, probably didn't know what it meant. You've heard people say, yada, yada, yada. It's I know, I know, I know. But it's used in the book of Genesis as a euphemism for intercourse. Because remember when Abraham knew his wife Sarah and she conceived? Yeah, you see, the idea of deep and intimate knowledge. But it isn't just on one plane. It's that relationally we would be connected and joined and have time with each other, that emotionally we would come to know each other, hear each other's hearts and passions and fears, and we would feel connected, including connected spiritually. You see, in fact, that relationship building of yada, you see, the word yada is used twice as often in the book of Genesis to refer to how God knew the heart of Abraham, as it is used to describe the intimacy of sexual union between a man and a woman. The idea of being known and to know deeply. In fact, relationally, that is foreplay. for a couple to take the time and make the time and make the priority of deeply knowing each other's heart, of connecting. And so that our sexual connection grows out of this sense that it's safe, that we know and are committed to each other, that we're not being used and discarded, we're being treasured and valued. And so, just as God knows us intimately, he invites us to come close to the understanding of what it is to be one, that we would know each other intimately. And he does that in the context of a committed marriage relationship. You see, that's why Adam and Eve, in knowing and being known intimately, nakedly, they could be naked and not ashamed. They didn't have anything to fear. That's how it was intended before the fall, and it's how it's intended now after the fall. Sexual oneness by God's design is beautifully giving ourselves to one another with the desire to bring pleasure to our partner, our marriage partner, and to do that for a lifetime. And for some of you who perhaps have difficulty having Bible reading holding your attention, perhaps the Song of Songs would be helpful to you. It's kind of a different facet of Bible reading because it's really the journal entries of a honeymoon. It's the description of how these two people so in love could enjoy the exploration of knowing each other and bringing each other pleasure. Now, for instance, when she says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Let the king bring me into his chambers." Hear the invitation. Hear the anticipation. Now, when I get to work, and it's fun to work with young people who come wanting pre-marriage counseling, who have desired to keep themselves pure for their marriage. And yet they're wanting to be able to add to the relationship they've been building a very healthy view of what would their sexuality be like, and how, what would they need to be sensitive to, and how would they express it in a way that would be rich and God-honoring and a blessing to their partner. I recently had an opportunity to work with a young couple that were doing just that. And it was delightful and beautiful to see their desire to be sensitive to each other and to what might be the challenges they would each have in adding this new part to their relationship. You see, God's word makes it clear that sexual intimacy in the commitment of marriage is intended to be a beautiful thing, a caring thing, a gift of love enjoyed for a lifetime. Now, that being said, that isn't all of our experience. We live in a culture that exposes us, all of us, including our children, to this world's philosophy and values regarding sexuality. We're exposed to so many sexual images repeatedly throughout the day, some subtly, others obscenely, in advertising, on our phones, on TV, movies. The values presented seem to set it as a cultural norm to take what I want when I want it. It isn't about that sort of building of relationship, that expressing of commitment, that consideration of how these things affect my partner. But it would seem that if there is an attraction, if there's chemistry, it must be acted on sexually. The philosophy promotes a self-gratification, a self-indulgence that seems to insist on no limits. You see, we hear the expression that the grass seems greener on the other side of the fence. I recently heard someone suggest that that's a good indication it's time to water. And perhaps what you really need to do is make sure you're tending your own marriage and you're developing that in a way that allows the grass to flourish on your side of the fence. Yet, sadly, so many have missed the blessing and exchanged the joyful giving of ourselves to one another to a view of sexuality that is much more about getting. You see, it's about conquest and control. Are you getting any lately? That's what we hear our world asking. Or taking what isn't ours to have. Leaving hurt and pain behind, insecurity and jealousy, in our demand to control and seek our own gratification on our own terms in our own time. Even among Christian couples, that insistence that I want what I want when I want it, and if I don't get what I want when I want it, I'm going to make it miserable. That's not the act of love. We've bought into a different philosophy. We may be using all the same body parts, but with a very different purpose. Vastly different. We're treating, instead of treating our sexuality as a sacred union to be celebrated and to the desire to bring pleasure to our partner and care and attention with sensitivity to them, it's not about giving, it's about getting and taking. You see, the direction is entirely different. In a gift, we give. But this is about taking what I want, when I want, without regard to how it would affect the other. You see, instead of believing it's our right and entitlement to take whatever we see and want, indulging our appetite, feeding our lust without considering how it would affect the other. To get and take rather than to give. See, the enemy would very much like to take what God gave as good and have us treat it in a way that makes it serve the purposes of evil. You see, if we see one another, whether it be our partner or others, as needing to be treated with honor. Not seeing people as objects to be used for our gratification and then discarded, but seeing them as people to be treated as valuable, that we don't have the right to take what would simply be self-serving. I'm very thankful that I have 4 grown children, and I'm very thankful that I have opportunities at various times to just talk with each of them about anything and everything. It's been a wonderful journey to be on, and as they discover and find their way in the world. And on one recent visit with my son, he invited me along to a course that was being offered to coach men in how to gain confidence with women. I thought, you know, and I was kind of honored to be invited along. And actually, I was the only dad there. We were the only father-son team, you see, who came to this coaching course on how to have confidence with women. However, I will tell you, it was one of the stranger events I've ever been to. And it certainly didn't represent anything of the philosophy I'm trying to share with you here. You see, because it turned out to be a coaching class focused on helping these fellows develop pickup approaches. It was about using women to help men feel good about themselves. It was kind of a dating approach comparable to catch and release if you were a fisherman. The difference, however, was that with fishing, the fish carries on relatively unharmed. However, when people are treated as objects of conquest, intended to bolster our ego, We leave a wake of hurt and brokenness. We leave shame and rejection. And people lose a sense of their own value and their own dignity. They lose a sense of who God made them to be. Yet every day in my work counseling, I encounter those who come having felt discarded and broken, those who have been used and abused. They so want to be loved and valued. So many instead feel shamed. One young woman said to me, after her fifth failed relationship, and in the most recent situation, she'd been involved in a relationship with a married man, believing he was going to leave his wife for her. And she said, there's got to be another way to live. There is. There is. We at times have failed to introduce our children and our society around us that there is another way, a good way, and a pleasing way to enjoy life and relationship, to be able to live out our sexuality in a way that doesn't rob us of our honor and our dignity. And we as the church at times have failed to address sexual things in a good and godly way. We've in fact thought we shouldn't talk about that. And so then we just surrender the whole area to the enemy instead of talking about what is the way God would have us deal with these so important matters. Well, we can't leave the world to be the only ones that offer instruction. I really don't care to go to more of those coaching sessions. He asked me if I'd been dating much. And I told him probably not as much as I need to, but I pretty much only date my wife. So occasionally I date my daughters as well. And I really wasn't looking to branch out from that. So I don't think he thought he could be too much help to me. And I agreed. Nevertheless, when we look at 2 Samuel, it's going to show us some of the sad outcomes of an uncontrolled sexual appetite, indulging without limit. We've seen what happens when entitlement and the desire to take control takes over. We'll see that it's not love that has sex by force. No person is ever ours to control. And that it is an act of violence, that rape, and in this case, rape that was also incest, is a sexual assault that in this case was covered up and pushed away, which is not uncommon. In fact, that is even when confronted, those who have sexually assaulted, 80% deny it. Well, you know, you might wish maybe when the elders were planning, could they have decided to just pass over this passage? I'm glad they didn't. Because although it's ugly and it's difficult, this history continues to repeat itself. A Stats Canada survey found that half of all women in Canada have experienced at least one incident of physical or sexual violence. The most recent statistics indicate that sexual assault is the only violent crime in Canada that has not declined in the last 20 years. Tragically, 80% of sexual assaults happens at the hands of family members, trusted friends, and partners. And the vast majority of these assaults go unreported. We have the warnings throughout Scripture that these problems will continue to occur among believers. Far too many of our sisters, and yes, our brothers, have experienced these kinds of sexual abuses, and they're in need of healing for these abuses. So let me introduce the cast of characters in today's story. We have Ammon, King David's firstborn son, the presumed heir apparent, living in the luxury of the palace court, used to having whatever he wants, entitled and self-indulgent, with no apparent sense of concern of how his choices would injure others. Oh, and we've got his cousin, Joadab. He's described as shrewd, but when we read the details of the story, we understand that that really is code for that he is a deceitful manipulator. And the advice he has for Ammon is to do whatever serves Ammon. And then we have Tamara. Tamara. She's described as a beautiful young woman, having lived a principled and pure life. She knew what God's word taught, and she was living by it. It seems that being told her brother was ill, she's thought nothing of going to help him. You see, when I was trying to imagine, you see, as long as we don't think of these as real people, it doesn't really get to us. But when I thought of Tamar, I thought, she sounds like my daughter Laura. My daughter Laura just has a sparkle for life. She's beautiful inside and out. And she lives her life with the intent of pleasing God and serving others. And she's just a joy to have around. There's a sparkle about her that lights up my day when I get a chance to be with her. And so when I was trying to think, what was this girl like? I imagined Laura, because I think that's how she's being described. I had a way of making this story have important impact. So, I think it's time we read it. So we're in 2 Samuel, 13th chapter, beginning at verse 1. In the course of time, Ammon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. So you get this, that they're half siblings. They have the same father, but different mothers. That was possible because David had 8 wives and 10 concubines. And so there was a lot of half-sisters in the courtyard, a lot of family. So Ammon became so obsessed with his sister Tamar that he made himself ill. She was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. You see, there would have been people who watched over the young daughters of the king. He didn't have access. Now, Ammon had an advisor named Jehonabad, son of Shemuel, David's brother. Jehonadab was a very shrewd man. He asked Ammon, "Why do you, the king's son, look so haggard in the morning after morning? Won't you tell me?" See, if you're the king's son, shouldn't you get anything you want whenever you want it? Aren't you entitled? Don't you deserve whatever it is you'd cast your eye on? That's the implication. Ammon said to him, "I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." Now, what Ammon calls love could more accurately be described as lustful obsession. He wants what isn't his to have. It's self-serving indulgence, seeking self-gratification. It's about demanding. It's a sense of entitlement that he knew was clearly outside of God's law. Now, lest we just think of him as the only villain, couldn't that describe most of us? Things that we know that are outside of God's law and intention for us, we still somehow pursue the desire. We somehow think, "I deserve that. I don't want to do it God's way. I'd rather do it mine." Now, it may not be this specific situation. But you see, so what we're knowing clearly is Ammon has a sin problem. But in this crowd, he's not alone. We all have a sin problem too. And it may live itself out in different ways. But we all have the challenge of saying, I'm not that concerned about God's will, God's law. I want to do things my way. I want to be in charge. So, you realize I haven't let him off the hook. It's just that I've added you to the hook. And I've added myself to the hook. I'm in this room too. But, you see, God has given us some instruction as believers about that we would somehow live differently. That we weren't supposed to just be like everyone else as his people. In fact, in Colossians, we read these instructions. Put to death, therefore, what belongs to the earthly nature: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. And further into Ephesians, we read, follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering, as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. But among you, there must not even be a hint of sexual immorality or of any kind of impurity or greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. We have this instruction in 1 Corinthians. You see, because it talks about living by love, then we get some definition of what would love God's style sound like. And in 1 Corinthians 13, we read, love is patient. You might want to consider how this compares to what Ammon called love. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It does not self-seek. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. It always protects. It always trusts. It always hopes. It always perseveres. Love never fails. That's the kind of love that doesn't go away. It's a choice. Quite different than the advice Joadab was providing. Where do you look for your direction? Do you look to say, what would God have me do? How would God have me handle relationship? Would I ask his Spirit to fill me with love so that I would treat people this way and consider them? Or are our values shaped by what we see in the media? The statement that's made that's called garbage in and garbage out. That if we have been desensitized by such exposure to another culture, another philosophy, other than that which God would direct us toward, it can seem okay because it's not as bad as some people. That isn't the standard. So, we'll carry on with the story. This is Joadab's advice. Go to bed and pretend to be ill, Joadab said. When your father comes to see you, say to him, I would like my sister Tamar to come and give me something to eat. Let her prepare the food in my sight so I may watch her and then eat from her hand. So Ammon laid down and pretended to be ill. When the king came to see him, Ammon said to him, I would like my sister Tamar to come and make some special bread in my sight so that I may eat from her hand. David sent word to Tamar at the palace, go to the house of your brother Ammon and prepare some food for him. So Tamar went to the house of her brother Ammon, who was lying down, and she took some dough and kneaded it and made bread in his sight and baked it. Then she took it from the pan and served him the bread, but he refused to eat. Send everyone out of here, Ammon said. So everyone left him. Then Ammon said to Tamar, bring the food here to my bedroom so that I may eat from your hand. Tamar took the bread she'd prepared and brought it to her brother Ammon in his bedroom. But when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her. And he said, "Come to bed with me, my sister." "No, my brother," she said. "Don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me and what? How could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You'd be looked at as a wicked fool in Israel. Please speak to the king. He will not keep you from being married to you." But he refused to listen to her. And since he was stronger than she, he raped her. Then Ammon hated her with an intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. Ammon said to her, "Get up and get out." "No," she said. "Sending him away would be a greater wrong than what you have already done to me." But he refused to listen to her. He called his personal servant and said, "Get this woman out of my sight and bolt the door after her." So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her. This beautiful young woman, his half-sister, went to him in kindness, believing he was sick. She didn't do anything wrong. Although, having met with so many people who have had a similar experience, I'm sure she second-guessed herself, rethought every movement, everything that was said and done, and she probably found a way to blame herself for the violation. Because that's just what happens when people are abused. They think they're to blame. She'd said no. She pled for him not to force her. She reminded him that this was a wicked thing and shouldn't happen. She asked him to consider how it would affect her, and that if he had had any concern for her, he wouldn't have done it. But he was only interested in what he wanted, dominance and control. It's very important that we understand that rape is not an act of passion. It's not about love. It never is. Rape is an act of violence, using power to dominate and force to control. That's why he could go from wanting her to hating her in an instant. Remember when we read about love? It said it didn't change. It said that love endured. This isn't love. But instead, he had contempt for her and saw her as disposable because she was only, in his eyes, someone to be used. And she was shamed and dishonored, violated and rejected. And very sadly, that has been the experience of many of our sisters in this room. By sending her out of the house, he left the appearance that she had done something wrong, that she had violated him in some way. You see, he found a way of blaming his vile actions on her. Sort of sounds like some of the recent court cases of celebrities we're hearing about in the news, or even about the things that came out in the campaign about locker room talk, where those with power use it to shame and blame those who they have victimized. God's not okay with that. Neither should we be. But carrying on with the story. She was wearing an ornate robe, for this was the kind of garment the virgin daughter of the king wore. She was able to celebrate what was pure. Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the ornate robe that she was wearing. She put her hands on her head and went away, weeping aloud as she went. Her brother Absalom said to her, "Has that Ammon, your brother, been with you? Be quiet, for now, my sister, he is your brother. Don't take this thing to heart." And Tamar, living with her brother in Absalom's house, a desolate woman. When King David heard all of this, he was furious. And Absalom never said a word to Ammon, either good or bad. He hated Ammon because he disgraced his sister Tamara. Tamara felt the grief of her loss, and she expressed it. At that moment, she needed someone to communicate that she had value, to show compassion. She needed someone to hear her, believe her, not blame her, and to protect her. Because those are the things that are needed when someone is abused and assaulted. Her brother saw the signs, but then he shut her down. He silenced her, perhaps not wanting shame to be seen publicly of the family. Far too many of those who've been wounded by sexual assault have been shut down, silenced, when they need someone. They needed us to hear their story, to believe them, to not blame them, to protect them from those who had robbed their dignity. Tamar was lovely and full of life at the beginning of the story. And now at the end of the story, she's described as desolate, empty, hollow, not feeling any sense of value. She'd been shut down and she didn't believe now she had worth or a future. The long-lasting effects of sexual abuse is not what the perpetrator did. The long-lasting effects of sexual abuse rest in how principal caregivers respond. If we show value to those who have been injured, if we show compassion, if we hear them, believe them, if we don't blame them, but instead protect them, then they can be expected to be restored. We who are God's people need to be there with compassion. Throughout history, God has always been on the side of the vulnerable, the oppressed, and the abused. We need to be the safe place where it can be very clear that those who've been treated poorly, shamefully, that they can know that they have not lost value in God's eyes or in ours. I recall a woman coming for counseling. But before she could start, she needed to know if I thought it was possible that a wife could be raped by her husband. You see, she didn't know if it would be safe to ask for help. She needed to know that she was not property to be used. She needed to know that she had a choice to give herself in relationship, and it wasn't something she could or should be pressured into or physically forced into. Those who have been taken advantage of on in dates need to know it's not okay. It needs to be clear that no one has the right to treat another that way. We need to know that what others have done to them does not diminish their value or their purity before God or before us, His people. We also need to be there for every man, young and old, to help them find God-honoring ways to take control of our sexuality and to use our power to serve God's kingdom and His purposes. Ammon needed the involvement of a godly man in his life to challenge his sense of entitlement and to help him use his power to serve others, not for self-indulgence. Perhaps Ammon learned directly or indirectly from his father David, that he could use his position to indulge his own desires without regard for how his choices would affect others. David may not have felt he had the moral authority to instruct his son. It's not good enough that David was furious. He needed to reach out with compassion, valuing Tamar in her brokenness. And he needed with a firm love to challenge and correct Ammon. Both lives were broken and needed repair. It only comes when we face things head on. You see, our God is a redeemer. He restores brokenness in lives. He sets us back on track. We, as brothers, fathers, and grandfathers, need to address our own hearts and attitudes. How will we honor our sisters and all women? How will we treat those who are most vulnerable? will we demonstrate God's Spirit at work, living love. If, like David, we need to take responsibility for sins of our past, when we have acted in self-indulgent ways, dominated, demanded our own way, without regard for others, it's time to repent and to walk in a new way. There may be, not to presume that we have raped, but to know that we've used power to dominate and control and get our own way. If that's something you need to put right with God this morning, I've asked the elders to come and be up at the front that you could have someone pray with you. And by the same token, for those who have been injured and wounded and are sorting through the feelings of not having been treated with honor, I also want to invite those folks to come forward, and I've asked some of the women to come and be here to pray with you. You see, our God showed us an example in Jesus that he came to serve, not to be served. We can learn from his example, because as Corinthians reminds us, love is patient, love is kind, love does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It does not keep a record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always preserves. Love never fails. When our Creator made us, He said that what He made is good. In fact, He said it was very good. Although He knows all of our weakness, He also knows what we are becoming. He will complete the good work He has begun in us. And it's a beautiful thing. He welcomes you to join Him in completing His masterpiece. Now, when people preach, they often tell you to make sure you apply this. And for some of you, you may be eager to go home and apply some of the things I've spoken up. I hope you do. Others of you, the applying may be quite a challenge because you may be dealing with some painful heart stuff. And I'm going to ask as we sing our last song that those men and women, our elders and deacons and ladies in the church that would come and be available at the front to pray with anyone who would like prayer on any of these matters or others. We're going to finish up there, but our God is able to take what is broken and ugly and make what is beautiful forever. May God bless you, and may you enjoy what He intended for you and for our sexuality.